Hi, listening friend. Welcome to the Monday edition of Mark and Friends. It's December 30th, 2013. It's New Year's Eve Eve. I have a two-day special entitled Trail of Two Kings. You're going to learn all about Herod the Great and the greatest king of all times, the Lord Jesus Christ. Enjoy today and tomorrow's broadcast.
I warned you I was not to be disturbed.
But, Your Greatness, their visit was unprecedented.
Princes, kings, magi, I don't care what they call themselves.
Greatness, I would not have troubled you, except they insisted we ought to know something of a new king.
What new king? A rival? From where?
They didn't say. They suggested you might know.
I withdraw my hasty judgment, Joachim. Send them in at once.
Aye, sire.
In the long parade of history's despots and dictators, Herod the Great is a standout. Ambitious, suspicious, but mostly vicious. That's Herod. The cunning of a cobra. The killer instincts of a piranha. Herod's language was power. And his currency, treachery. Against the bright backdrop of the Christmas story, Herod lingers, a sinister shadow. There is no escaping him on the trail of two kings. He was born in 73 BC in southern Palestine. His father, Antipater, was an Idumean, a descendant of the Edomites, who found great favor with Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. In 47 BC, Caesar conferred upon Antipater the rare honor of Roman citizenship and a position as procurator of Judea. That same year, Antipater named his son, Herod, governor of Galilee. 6 years later, Herod was promoted to tetrarch. And by 37 BC, at the age of 36, Herod became the uncontested ruler of Judea, a scepter he would grasp for the next 33 years. Herod was a Jew only because years before, Edomites living in Judah had been forced to convert to Judaism. In a move designed to solidify his acceptance by the Jews, Herod divorced his first wife, Doris, and removed her from his court, marrying a Hasmonean princess named Mariamne. The divorce was the first of many chess-like moves Herod engineered in a lethal game where he determined to be the last king standing.
He was called Herod the Great for a reason.
Dr. Tony Maloof is Associate Professor of Missions at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, Fort Worth, Texas. The Lebanese-born teacher is the author of Arabs in the Shadow of Israel.
He had massive building projects in the land of Israel and a solid grip on the country's affairs and earned him that title. However, he was an insane king and power-hungry and does not count to 10 before killing any potential rival.
So, in the grand scheme of things, Herod was first and foremost a schemer. Erez Soref is president of Israel College of the Bible in downtown Jerusalem and sums up the perspective of most historians.
Viewed as a con man of sorts, somewhat appreciated for his massive building projects, but still viewed largely as an Edomite, half-Jew, non-kosher king that kind of sneaked his way up to the kingdom. So not very positive generally in early Christian or Jewish literature, yeah.
But just how great is Herod the Great in the perspective of modern Israelis? Samuel Smadja is manager of Sarel Tours in Israel.
When you talk to the average Israeli on the street, the average Israeli sees Herod as a builder. He gave a big boost to this country in constructing and leaving us so many sites.
One of the most impressive of those sites is known as Masada. Towering 1,424 feet above the Dead Sea, Masada is equal parts engineering marvel and military genius. It was here, beginning in 37 BC, that Herod built his winter palace and fortress.
We're standing on the northern edge of Masada. We're actually looking out toward the Dead Sea. Off in the distance is En Gedi, and we're standing in the palace of King Herod.
Dr. Charlie Dyer is provost of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago and is a licensed tour guide in Israel.
There were two palaces on Masada, but this happens to be the one that was his personal palace on the northern edge. It's actually probably the nicest spot on Masada, even on a day like today where it's going to be over 100. This palace gets the breeze, so if there's any breeze coming along at all, you can feel it in this area. The view is absolutely magnificent.
By all accounts, Herod had an eye for beauty, whether his walls or his wives. And Masada is no exception.
Yeah, my hands right now are just touching what's plaster, but when you look at it, it's designed in a way that looks like marble panels. It was designed in a faux marble look. And then, of course, they were painted over so people wouldn't know that they were just plaster. Herod designed it with that aesthetic eye, that eye toward beauty, so that even this little anteroom we're in gives the impression of a marbled palace of luxury.
But Masada was just one of many palaces Herod built. Another is found near the ruins of the old city of Jericho.
Well, Jericho is the famous place in the world.
Khalid Abdelrazik owns the Mount of Temptation restaurant in Jericho.
Everybody knows Jericho. Jericho, the older city in the world. When you come to Jericho, you like Jericho very much. The area here smells like flowers. That means Jericho flowers, you know. And Jericho is a banana and the orange and the fruit. Every day, I like Jericho very much. Really.
Apparently, Herod the Great shared that enthusiasm. Dr. Charlie Dyer.
In Old Testament, Jericho was over in that direction because that's where the spring was, Elijah's spring. The water was there. That's why the Old Testament city was there. But Herod comes along and decides, I want to build a newer Jericho. I want to build a Jericho that has my amenities to it. And of course, with Herod, that meant luxury and security. Well, there's no water here. No problem. Several miles up this stream that's in front of us is a natural spring. Herod builds an aqueduct to bring the water from that spring down to his palace complex. He wants the security as well. So just behind us, he built a giant fortress, named it after his mother, Kypros. But this becomes his Palm Springs, his winter haven, a place where he can come in the winter months and enjoy himself.
Samuel Smadja.
He's not remembered as a great lover of the Jews, but they, if you want to say, they even maybe forgive him for that because he left so many great monuments.
Among the greatest, Caesarea, the harbor and city built by Herod the Great against all odds and nature itself. Charlie Dyer.
We're leaning against the foundations of Herod's palace in Caesarea. The sound in the background of the waves literally crashing against the rocks just in front of us. It's one of the most spectacular views. It really does capture Herod's sense of grandeur and beauty. He built a palace that extended out into the Mediterranean at Caesarea and put a freshwater pool out over the salt water of the Mediterranean.
It was a massive undertaking that took 12 years. Herod the Great built a deep sea harbor, an aqueduct, a hippodrome, and a theater. Writing about Herod's maritime masterpiece, the historian Flavius Josephus wrote,
"The king triumphed over nature and constructed a harbor so successfully that the solidity of its masonry defied the sea, while its beauty was such as if no obstacle had existed."
Of course, knowing very well who his patrons were, the ones who kept him in power, he names it after Caesar. The Herod who built a temple to God in Jerusalem is the Herod who built a temple to Caesar at Caesarea, at the mouth of the harbor. So everyone coming in would remember the might of Rome and Augusta, the patrons of Herod the Great.
Dr. Michael Rydelnik is professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute.
I'd say there's three things that people don't understand about Herod. That he was paranoid for his throne. That he was ruthless. He would do anything to preserve it. And then on the other hand, he was a great builder. And because he had all these great projects, in many ways, he was an accomplished king.
I mean, his building projects were, they were nothing short of awesome.
Dr. Michael Wexler, Associate Professor of Bible at Moody.
You know, the Second Temple, he expanded and enlarged so that we even have very significant remnants of it to this day. what we call the Western Wall, where the Jewish people pray. His projects were so big, intensive, and the time and energy that they took and material, that there are many, many testimonies and remnants to them to this day.
Consider the Herodium. 4 years in the making. A palace built in the hollow of a man-made mountain. 3 miles southeast of Bethlehem, the Herodium is the only one of Herod's many projects that bears his name. Historian Flavius Josephus saw it at its prime and observed,
200 steps of purest white marble led up to it. Its top was crowned with circular towers. Its courtyard contained splendid structures.
The Herodium is a cone-shaped edifice that required the labor of thousands of slaves, who literally moved the top of one hill to the top of another, the one that would house Herod's palace. The Herodium included a swimming pool large enough for boats. And no Herod dwelling would be complete without a bath complex, the influence of Rome. Dr. Charlie Dyer.
We're standing in the Tepidarium. It's actually part of Herod the Great's bath complex. I can look out from here. I see the courtyard he built inside this volcano-shaped area. Just beyond it, I can see the triclinium, his banqueting hall.
To explore the Herodium, touching its well-preserved columns, is to encounter a sensation that can only be described as eerie.
Walk through here and you literally can touch something and know Herod the Great was probably touching this very spot. This is exactly as it would have been. It connects you with history in a way that you wouldn't think possible otherwise.
Not surprising, observes Rafi Shalev, deputy director of marketing for the Israeli Government Tourism Office.
Suddenly you see that the Holy Land and where everything took place is really a microcosm that began here in a very small area that any person wanting to come in 10 days could actually visit the land and go back with a lot of memories.
An important footnote to the story of the Herodium. Historians have long puzzled over the location of Herod the Great's tomb. In 2007, after more than 3 decades of digging at the Herodium, archaeologist Ehud Netzer made the discovery. The long pursuit left him with distinct impressions of Herod the Great as a builder and administrator.
If I judge his way of doing by his architecture, I think he was looking far. He knew what he is doing. And I believe through his architecture that he was a great administrator.
Great architect, great builder, great administrator, Herod the Great. Unfortunately, he was also Herod the paranoid, Herod the maniac, Herod the murderer. A disturbing look at Herod's dark shadow on the manger scene when we return to The Trail of Two Kings.
And putting this into 2 days of broadcasts, parts 1 and 2 today. You're listening to the Monday edition of Mark and Friends, and we'll jump into part 2.
Luxury and power. Herod the Great indulged them both. Born in 73 BC, this Roman-backed ruler of Judea clung to his kingship with a literal death grip. Nizar Tuma pastors a church in Israel, and he says, at the name of Herod,
something in you shrinks, you know. Just you have these feelings. Because the history of Herod was not so great. There is always blood in this dynasty. There's always something great happening, I mean, in the bad sense, in the story and the destiny of Herod the Great.
One of the many dark chapters of Herod's story unfolded at his palace in Jericho in 35 BC. Call it a pool party gone bad. Dr. Charlie Dyer recounts.
His favorite wife was Mariamne, and her younger brother was named Aristobulus. At 17 years old, Herod put him into the high priesthood. Mariamne and Aristobulus were from the Hasmonean line. They were from the line that had been the rulers in Judah before. And Herod, in essence, married into legitimacy, being king. But when Aristobulus went up at a 17-year-old and offered the sacrifices, the people cheered, they wept, and Herod took note of it. A short time afterward, Herod came down to Jericho and he invited Aristobulus to come with him. And it was a warm day, and Herod said, you know, why don't you go swimming, Aristobulus? And coaxed the young man to go into the pool. Herod also invited some of his bodyguards to go in and horse around with the boy. And accidentally, Aristobulus drowned in the pool. He'd only been high priest for less than a year. He was 18 years old and was killed. His wife never forgave him for that. But in Herod's mind, the people liked him. That makes him a potential rival. Kill him.
It was a pattern from which Herod seldom deviated. The death warrant for the next victim, easily signed with the blood of the previous. Herod the Great took paranoia where it had rarely gone before. No one, including his favorite wife, escaped his suspicion. The beautiful Mariamne, Herod's teenaged bride, eventually gave him 3 sons and 2 daughters. Apparently, Herod loved Mariamne to the point of possession. He could never bear the thought of her being with another man should he die. On 2 occasions, Herod left instructions before leaving for a distant trip that should he die before returning, Mariamne was to be killed, sating Herod's extreme jealousy, even in death. Upon discovering this edict, Mariamne was incensed at Herod's return. The plot thickened as Herod's sister, Salome, falsely accused Mariamne of adultery. Ultimately, Mariamne was put on trial, convicted, and executed in 29 BC. Immediately, her mother, Alexandra, declared that Herod was insane and proclaimed herself the rightful queen. Herod responded by executing her without a trial.
So we get a sense that Herod was ruthless, willing to hold on to power at whatever cost, the cost to his own family and friends. And yet, psychologically, that was a struggle for him, so that he'd kill his wife and then call out her name as if she was still around, not realizing, indeed, she was gone.
To follow the trail of King Herod is to follow a trail of blood. Ultimately, he murdered his wife, her 2 sons, her brother, her grandfather, and her mother. In 7 BC, Herod suspected his sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, of plotting against him. Both were executed. In 4 BC, the ever-suspecting Herod became convinced that his firstborn and heir to the throne, Antipas, was threatening him. The young man was killed. How many others were hung, stoned, stabbed, or tortured, we can only imagine. These are just the few names history has preserved. Suffice it to say that Herod and death were familiar acquaintances. Herod the Great or Herod the Grim? It came down to which end of the sword you faced. This was the mood, and this was the man to whom the wise men of Matthew's gospel came, full of supernatural anticipation.
Dinner was exquisite, Majesty.
Indeed, a welcome refreshment on a difficult journey.
You, Magi, seem troubled. Why have you come? How may I help you? Good king, we beg and implore you, do tell us, where is he?
Whom do you seek?
The newborn king, I say.
Which king?
Well, the king of the Jews, of course.
Surely
you've heard of him.
Or seen his star, the one we saw in the east. It guided us all the way here to Jerusalem.
Yeah. If I may say, great king, it is now you who seems troubled.
Well, indeed I am. How is it a thing as magnificent as this star escapes the notice of my own astronomers?
Who can say?
But perhaps you are mistaken. Perhaps the star leads elsewhere.
Gaspar makes no such mistakes. I dare say his knowledge of the heavens is unmatched anywhere, even in the halls of this exquisite palace.
Tell me again, exactly when did this star appear?
Great king, we have already spoken of these things. Our time is short, and we must find this child who is called King of the Jews. Have you no word?
I have not one, but 2.
2? Twice blessed are we, and this in addition to your hospitality.
First, go to Bethlehem. Just a 1-hour journey. An easy ride for your camels. Search carefully, and you will find the child you seek.
Bethlehem.
Second, When you have found the child, do me the kindness of returning to let me know where he lives. Like you, I have a special interest in him and wish to worship. But I am guided by the star of my soul.
A star whose orbit was as twisted as Herod's soul was troubled. No wonder Matthew records that Herod was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. Dr. Tony Maloof.
Really, the Magi didn't come to Jerusalem in a very humble fashion. They might have really come in caravans, and being kings, they were accompanied by a large convoy of servants, and also the guards came in a majestic, probably, caravan. And no wonder all Jerusalem was troubled with Herod when they heard of their coming.
Scripture offers few specifics about these wise men, other than that they came from the east, having followed an unusual star. But where in the east? There are differing viewpoints. Again, Tony Maloof.
One of the church fathers, Tertullian, tells us that those magi were kings from the Orient. And he points to more specifically to Arabia as their country of origin.
Maybe not, says Michael Wexler.
Well, actually, the Magi were from Persia. The Magi were the religious scholars belonging to what is otherwise known as Zoroastrianism, which is a very old faith, which revolved around the stars, the constellations.
The important thing is to understand not those details, but the fact that they recognized that there was something astounding that was happening.
Michael Van Lanningham.
They were the ones who responded to it. The religious leaders in Jerusalem didn't. Herod didn't respond in an appropriate way. It was Magi. They were the ones who responded right to the news of the birth of the Messiah.
Michael Rydelnik.
You've got these Gentiles who are way off in the east. They see, they have the scriptures, they see the sign in the heaven, and off they go. And they have this long trek through the wilderness on camels in a caravan with the threat of robbers. They carry expensive gifts with them, and they come. And what do they say? We have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him.
And so they assume that as the king of Israel, he would be desirous and looking for the same thing. So they assumed about his character, of course, that it was better than it really was.
The understatement of understatements. A further hint at Herod's shady character is found in Matthew's gospel. He records that, quote, Herod called the Magi secretly. Tony Maloof points out that the meeting was by no means merely social.
When he calls them to himself, he called them because he knew that this is a serious matter. It's not like a couple of people from an insignificant social class that are just coming to seek. Those are dignitaries coming to pledge allegiance to the newborn king of the Jews. And this is a real threat to his kingdom and to his power and to his throne.
We do know that Herod was remarkable in terms of his ability to wine and dine people. He, in 42 B.C., sided with Mark Antony when Antony was opposed to Octavian, who later called himself Augustus and eventually became the emperor of Rome.
It's always bad to be on the losing side in a power struggle. But Herod went immediately to Octavius, to Augustus, and said, I served Antony loyally, and I will serve you loyally. And Octavius was so impressed that he let him remain in power. It was Herod saying, I don't know who's in charge of Rome, but I serve Rome.
So Herod had a remarkable ability to manipulate people and situations to do what he wanted to have happen.
Well, definitely, Herod did not really reveal his intent from the meeting. I mean, he was really inquiring about this newborn king of the Jews and the time and the date of the appearance of the star in the heavenlies that those magi have seen in the east. And he was just inquiring for the sake of trying to get rid of his rival.
If somebody came in and said, I heard somebody might be speaking against you, Herod would call them in and kill them. But before that was done, somebody might say, well, actually, no, that guy might have been against you. He'd have him killed as well. So Herod would say he wasn't paranoid. People were out to get him. And he ruled by absolute brutality.
So what might that meeting have been like? Was Herod friendly or merely cordial? And did his gentle plying cause them to sense intrigue? Or did they simply view it as a peer meeting, royals among royalty? Dr. Rydalnik.
Well, I think, first of all, you can imagine the offense that Herod faced. These guys show up and they say, "Where is he who is born king of the Jews? We have seen his star in the east." Herod was not born king of the Jews. He was appointed by the Romans.
And when the wise men came from foreign countries and they asked him, "Well, where is that king?" In other words, "Where's the real king, you phony king?" And these are non-Jews. Of course, he did not appreciate that at all.
So here he is, an appointed king, and all of a sudden these wise men show up and they want to know, "Where's the born king, the real king?" You can just imagine the threat that he faced here. He now knows that there's a star in the east, there's a sign in the heavens that the star from Jacob has come.
But when the Magi fail to cooperate, Herod's rage is unhinged. Stay with us as we travel further on the trail of two kings.
This concludes part one and two of Tale of Two Kings. On the Tuesday edition of Mark and Friends tomorrow, you'll hear the third and fourth edition of this special. I hope you're being blessed by our Christmas music through tomorrow night. So keep listening. May God bless you through this Christmas and New Year holiday season. This is Mark Burns with the Ministry of Great News Radio. God bless you and have a great day and night.